Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation and the world. This week we present author and columnist Christopher Hitchens, who explains why he believes former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger should be tried for war crimes, a case made in his recently published book, The Trial of Henry Kissinger. Earth First activist Daryl Cherney, who discusses the lawsuit he filed against the Oakland, California Police Department and FBI for falsely charging him and his late colleague Judy Barry of transporting a bomb which exploded in their car in 1990. And Bobby Seale, co-founder of the Black Panther Party, who relates the radical politics of the 1960s to the rebirth of activism and today's growing worldwide movement for social justice. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On August 30th, East Timor will take its first big step toward full independence. Qualified voters will elect an 88-member assembly that will craft the Pacific Island nation's first constitution, leading to full sovereignty in early 2002. The path to independence started 2 years ago, when island voters in a United Nations plebiscite overwhelmingly voted to break away from Indonesia, which had illegally occupied the island in 1975 after Portugal abandoned colonial rule. Once the Timorese voted to seek independence, pro-Indonesian militia groups terrorized the island, burned villages, and attacked international observers, all with the assistance of the Indonesian military. In the violence, over 1,000 Timorese were killed, and some 80,000 East Timorese fled into Indonesian-controlled West Timor, where they were forced to live in refugee camps that are controlled by the militia. For the last 2 years, the UN has run East Timor. But the UN has fumbled its mission in many ways, including failing to work with Timorese in setting up the island's administrative structures that will soon be handed over to the island's new leaders. Furthermore, the International Monetary Fund now controls East Timor's currency, and there is confusion about how the mix of American dollars, Australian dollars, and Indonesian currency will function. Charlie Shiner, founder of the East Timor Action Network, says the process for complete independence is being rushed. He strongly advocates the immediate repatriation of refugees from camps in West Timor and the convening of a full war crimes tribunal to expose the abuses of Indonesian rule since 1975. In a spirited carnival-like scene last year, protesters marched down the streets of Buenos Aires, Argentina. They were headed to the home of Leopoldo Galtieri, the former dictator of the South American country who left office in 1983. While in power, Galtieri was believed to have run a ring of people who kidnapped and tortured left-leaning activists. The protesters are part of Hijos, a street-savvy group that is dedicated to exposing human rights abusers of the past and to make their current lives more difficult. On this particular night, protesters quickly clashed with riot police and tear gas soon filled the night air. The ranks of Hijos are filled with the children of the same 30,000 people, mostly social activists, who disappeared in Argentina from 1976 to 1983. Few of the military leaders who were in charge of the repression were ever brought to justice, and former President Carlos Menem pardoned 277 military officers who were convicted of violating human rights. The Out of Torture movement started in 1999 when people in Buenos Aires recognized former General Jorge Vidalia jogging through a park. Soon, activists started throwing eggs and shouting assassin and kidnapper at the former general. The morning jog was over, and the general was soon arrested on charges of stealing babies of left-wing families, a crime not covered by an earlier amnesty of military officers. Hijos activist Diego Genaud remarked, "We want all the murderers to go to jail with the political class that supported them, as well as the economic class that fueled the genocide, the same people who today run the country." U.S. Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill was supposed to be the strong, silent type. Coming from Alcoa, the aluminum giant, O'Neill was seen early on as providing stability to the capital markets and reassuring Wall Street that the new Bush administration had its act together. Instead, according to The Nation magazine, O'Neill has evolved into a flaky right-wing prophet, questioning the need for all corporate taxes and the necessity of popular government programs like Social Security and Medicare. By far, O'Neill's most extreme comments, published in a wide-ranging interview with the Financial Times, have to do with the wisdom of taxing big corporations and wealthy individuals. Following flawed economic theory, O'Neill insists that only individuals should pay taxes because corporations are legal shells and do not actually control any financial assets. Over the last 30 years, corporate America has succeeded in keeping the IRS at bay. In the mid-1960s, major corporations paid a 35% tax rate that fell to 10% after the 1981 Reagan tax bill. In the mid-90s, under the Clinton administration, the corporate tax rate rose to 21%. Although none of O'Neill's far-out notions are likely to be carried out anytime soon, it does put ideas into the heads of conservative policy wonks. After all, in 1990, no one would have dared talk about abolishing the inheritance tax. Yet with little difficulty, George W. Bush got Congress to axe it with the help of lots of moderate Democrats. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Zelfia Hunter.
The effort by human rights groups around the world to hold accountable tyrants and dictators for their past crimes has gotten a boost recently. The detention of former Chilean ruler General Augusto Pinochet in Britain and the arrest of Yugoslavia's former strongman Slobodan Milosevic and his transfer to The Hague to stand trial are two of the most dramatic examples of a new resolve to bring to justice those leaders who have committed gross human rights violations in times of war or in the name of preserving their own power. But author and columnist Christopher Hitchens believes that in our quest to punish those who are responsible for the murder and untold suffering of thousands of innocents, we here in the US ignore our own demons. In his book, The Trial of Henry Kissinger, Hitchens points the finger squarely at former Secretary of State Kissinger, who served under Presidents Nixon and Ford. Hitchens accuses Kissinger of complicity in assassinations, human rights abuses, and undermining democracy in Chile, East Timor, and Greece. He also charges the Nobel Prize winner of sabotaging the 1968 peace negotiations to end the Vietnam War in order to benefit Nixon's presidential campaign. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Hitchens, who explains why he believes Kissinger is a one-man international rolling crime wave who should be tried for war crimes.
Is it not the case that in every day's New York Times, for example, you will read one of two things, either a story about a country or society? It might be Serbia, it might be Germany, it might be Japan, it might be Rwanda, attempting to grapple with appalling crimes visited either on its own society or on others in the past. If you don't read that in the New York Times one day, and you're very likely to, you will read a stern lecture from some American United States high official urging these societies to get on with the task of investigating their past and bringing their wrongdoers to justice. In my opinion, the discrepancy between that condescending style and the unwillingness of the United States to think about, revisit, or examine critically its own past, it has now become too offensive, too surreal to be sustained. And if one wanted to symbolize it in a particular case, or perhaps one should say a particular career, then the one I've chosen is the one, because this is a one-man international rolling crime wave, the only unindicted member of the core of the Nixon administration, and the only unindicted member of a group of people with whom he was closely associated, Mr. Pinochet in Chile, Mr. Suharto in Indonesia, General Papadopoulos in Greece, most of whom are now either in jail or facing trial in their own countries. So his exemption from this is looking very startling to anyone who takes a real interest in these questions.
As far as the evidence you've compiled, some of it in the public domain for many years, but some of it new, classified files that the U.S. government has recently released. Could you describe some of the more potent pieces of evidence, or what some might call a smoking gun, if there is one, you know, in terms of Mr. Kissinger, and not just his being with a leader at the time a decision was made that cost many lives, but his actual participation?
Well, actually, the word smoking gun would apply very well to the people who killed General René Schneider, who was the conservative, constitutional-minded head of the Chilean armed forces in 1970. And by his insistence that the Chilean army, navy, and air force kept their oath only to the constitution of Chile, which had always had a tradition of democratic elections, was the main obstacle to the coup, the military coup, that Henry Kissinger wanted. Now, we've known for a long time that Henry Kissinger sent money and guns and encouragement to the people who were trying to kill, and eventually did kill, General Schneider. But we didn't know until last fall in Washington that after they had done it, in other words, where they stood over his body in the street by his car with smoking guns, that they were then paid off. In other words, that the money was given after the crime was committed, which completely seals the question. We move from the words, in other words, complicity, collaboration, collusion, the C words, to the much tougher A words, aiding, abetting, accomplice, accessory. It's as if they had shot him, Kissinger and his friends had shot Schneider themselves. You pay someone off after the crime, you can't stand around saying, oh, we were only trying to kidnap him. That's a smoking gun. And the investigations of that and many other atrocities in Chile and the Southern Hemisphere are creeping nearer to Kissinger all the time, and he knows it, and in my book I can show that he's demonstrated extreme nervousness about it. So that would be, that's my answer to any smoking gun challenge it's made to me.
When you look at the reaction around the world now to U.S. display of hypocrisy and arrogance with regards to cases like Henry Kissinger, with regards to issues of the blood spilled in places like East Timor and Guatemala, and we can go through a whole list, are we at some kind of interesting juncture in history where the United States, again, with so much military and economic power, is now being called into question as maybe it has never before?
Well, the United States is the only country that played any significant part at all in the Cold War not to have set up a Truth and Justice Commission or Truth and Reconciliation Commission to examine its own role in these events. It is not true to say that only the societies that, so to speak, lost the Cold War have had to do this. And in fact, the one that's probably done it the least next to the United States is Russia. But even there was glasnost and perestroika, a revisiting of the way that history was taught, some opening of documents and so forth. In other countries that were, if you like, on the winning side of the Cold War, such as Guatemala, Brazil, South Africa, there have been very searching inquiries into what happened. Only the United States appears to regard this question as irrelevant, that sees no reason at all to open its documents, to revisit its archives, to ask if it has any victims to account for or to compensate. Quite clearly what is overdue now, long overdue, and the Kerry case shows it. Many other cases will carry on showing it. There's no possibility, in other words, of evading it, and the Kissinger case makes it salient. What's needed is a Truth and Justice and Truth and Reconciliation Commission for the United States of America, set up properly in Washington and empowered to do a proper job of work. And I think if you asked me, I would say I'd have the justice first and then the reconciliation.
That was columnist Christopher Hitchens, author of The Trial of Henry Kissinger, published by Verso. In May 1990, a bomb exploded in the car of Oakland, California Earth First activists Judy Barry and Daryl Cherney. Barry was almost killed, while Cherney suffered lesser injuries. The Oakland Police Department and the FBI arrested Barry and Cherney while they lay in their hospital beds, charging them with carrying the device and of being terrorists who plan to use the bomb in their campaign to save Northern California's redwood forests from clear-cutting. With no evidence to back up their claims, authorities were forced to drop the charges, but not before conducting a damaging smear campaign against Earth First. In the 11 years since, Earth First activists have continued their direct action campaigns to save old-growth forests, but they have also sought justice in the courts over the bombing case. Barry and Cherney sued the Oakland police and the FBI for civil rights violations. Despite Judy Barry's death from cancer in 1997, the case has gone forward and a trial is set to begin October the 1st. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Daryl Cherney, who explains what the activists hope to gain from the lawsuit and the relevance of the case to progressive movements across the nation.
We were organising something called Redwood Summer. We were environmental organisers. We were basically promising to bring thousands of people from all over the United States to Northern California to protest for the Redwoods. And we represented a major threat to the timber industry. There was also an election going on at the time on the ballot. There was a forestry reform measure called Forest Forever, and the timber industry was extremely afraid of this measure because it would reform forest practices throughout the state of California. So they wanted to tarnish the image of environmentalists, at the same time, you know, destroy as many organizers as they could. We don't know who put the bomb in the car, but it certainly served the interest of the timber industry to have us taken out and then blamed for our own bombing.
The FBI agent who was in charge of the region at the time of the bombing, Richard Held, has a long and illustrious history being involved in many very well-known cases of people either being killed or put away for decades in prison in trials where they often did not receive justice. Leonard Peltier is certainly one of the more famous ones.
Judge Claudia Wilkin dismissed Richard Held from the case, and that dismissal was not something we can appeal.
If you win in this trial, what will you win? What do you hope to gain?
Well, we have put out a list of demands because the judge ordered us to have settlement conferences, and so that actually turned out to be a good thing because we solidified what it is we're seeking. In our list of demands to the FBI, we seek an investigation of the bombing. We seek an investigation of the investigators. We seek an apology for blaming us. We seek a disbanding of the Oakland Police's Intelligence Division that spies on activist groups in the San Francisco Bay Area. We seek our files to be completely opened. We seek for our names to be cleared. And we also ask for $20 million. If the case goes to trial, and we fully expect it to, I mean, we're going to trial. The FBI, by the way, has never made a counteroffer, nor has the Oakland Police. They have never expressed an interest in settling this case out of court, and we really want to see it go to trial, too. We're pretty committed to that, but let me assure you, the FBI plans on going to court as well. But if we go to trial, the only thing that we can get is money. We cannot get an investigation. However, we conduct our own investigation, and money can buy us private investigators and things of that nature. We have done, actually, private investigation, and we've come, by the way, a long way into learning more about who bombed us. But we're still not quite there yet.
Is there anything you can share about what you learned?
I'll tell you an interesting anecdote. Under oath, the FBI has testified that they had an informant, or possibly several informants, who said that two heavy hitters from the north, from Earth First, were coming down to Santa Cruz with a bomb. Now, if the FBI had an informant that knew a bomb was going to be in our car, then maybe the informant, not even maybe, definitely the informant, had prior knowledge of the bombing, as did the FBI. They've testified to that. I don't think they fully realized the implications of what they were saying at the time they were saying it. And so that the idea of informant as bomber is not so crazy. And there is an informant letter and one of Judy's death threats that was sent, in fact, by the same person. So somebody who tried to turn Judy in to the police also sent her her first death threat. And we're pretty sure we know who that person is, but I'm going to hold off on that for now as to naming his name.
Okay. You'll save that for the trial, I take it.
We will save it for when the time is right.
Okay. Your case has been described as potentially precedent-setting. Have there been other times where people who have suffered at the hands of the FBI have sued the FBI and actually has gone to trial?
Well, Fred Hampton, who was murdered by the Chicago police and the FBI, had his estate win, you know, several million dollars, but, you know, Fred Hampton was killed. He was the Black Panthers, great leader. You know, that was settled out of court. I do not believe that case went to trial. It is very rare that people take the FBI to trial for political reasons. I mean, for reasons that have to do with the FBI attacking us politically. There are employee-employer lawsuits against the FBI. The FBI has discriminated against African-American people, women, you know, people of color, and some of those people have taken the FBI to trial for employment lawsuits. And the Waco people sued the FBI. The people who were, you know, the families of the people burned to death in Waco sued the FBI, and they lost. Really, this is about raising consciousness and making the world a safer place from the FBI. It's not about Judy Barry and Daryl Cherney. It's about all of us being able to express ourselves politically without fear of repression.
That was Daryl Cherney of Earth First. To find out more about the lawsuit, call Earth First at area code 707-498-2700 or visit the plaintiff's website at www.judybarry.org. In the midst of the struggle for civil rights and growing opposition to the Vietnam War, Bobby Seale co-founded the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense with Dr. Huey P. Newton in 1966. Although the militant group was best known for its call for black power and violent confrontations with police, they became popular in America's poor inner-city neighborhoods by organizing free breakfast programs for schoolchildren, health clinics, and literacy classes. Bobby Seale and the leadership of the Panthers were the targets of the FBI's counterintelligence program, or COINTELPRO, that often use infiltrators and deadly force to suppress and divide the radical movements of the day. By 1969, 29 members of the Black Panther Party and 14 police officers were killed in shootouts around the US. Bobby Seale, the author of three books, including Seize the Time, was arrested numerous times, including a charge that he was complicit in the murder of a police informant in New Haven, Connecticut. He spent 2 years in jail before being freed after a jury failed to reach a verdict. On June the 20th, Seale returned to New Haven and spoke about the relationship between the radical politics of the 1960s and the rebirth of activism and today's growing worldwide movement for social justice.
In the whole history of human liberation struggles in various nations and nationalities, peoples, etc., there are always high tides and there are low tides, high tides and low tides that can last for generations. And in the 1960s protest movement era, there was a great high tide that involved so much. There was a whole big, broad, pragmatic, philosophical range that evolved, so to speak, in the 1960s protest movement era, which included the Black Panther Party. In a sense, my organization, the Black Panther Party, popped up right in the middle of an already ongoing, high-profile protest movement throughout the United States of America and around the world in a large sense. Protests against the war in Vietnam, the existing already ongoing civil human rights protests, civil rights protests, and various other advocates and organizational groups who's advocating human rights, etc. We popped up right in the middle of that. In 1966, Huey P. Newton and I, together, in a War on Poverty office, where I was employed by the city government of Oakland, California, Department of Human Resources. I was literally employed by the government at the time. We created the Black Panther Party in that War on Poverty office, where we wrote the first 10-point platform and program. Black Panther Party was one of the most profound, take no crap from the racist pig power structure, grassroots, progressive, class analysis style organization, which evolved out of the grassroots of the African-American community in this country. Black Panther Party was not separate from the civil rights movement. It was part of it. In fact, the Black Panther Party, because they murdered Martin Luther King, was catapulted into a broad spokesman but program organizing kind of leadership angle in opposition to what we call the racist pig power structure. I mean, the FBI counterintelligence program, that program, what they call the COINTELPRO, you can go to the Library of Congress right now and read, really, all the dirty tricks and the violation of constitutional rights of the Freedom of Information Act documents. You can read this stuff. You got still people laboring around here that the Black Panther Party was a black militant hate group. Oh, please, give me a break. We didn't have time for it. You're getting shot at, going to jail. You want all the friends you could get. And anyway, we picked up from Mao Zedong in a little red book, know the difference between your friends and your enemies. Another thing we picked up, we began to find out that some of these fools coming in our organization were nothing but black provocateur agents sent in by the FBI. So it ain't got nothing to do with no color. It has to do, I guess, what Martin Luther King would say, the content of your character. That's what it had to do with. I mean, by the end of 1969, I had 29 Black Panther Party members dead. 14 policemen were dead. And all those shootouts and attacks on our offices, because the particular year of 1969, they attacked every Black Panther Party office in this country at least once. Chicago had been attacked 3 times up to December 4th, 1969. Not until Senator Kennedy, Senator Church, and some others called a Senate investigation hearing of the FBI's concerted attempt to smash the Black Panther Party. Did, and they put him on the hot seat for a week, did the FBI stop going to police departments and working with police departments to get them and encourage them to attack our Black Panther Party office? Not until that happened. After that happened, there were no more attacks on our offices because of that Senate investigation hearing. The 1960s protest movement was not about only the Black Panther Party. It was about a lot of organizational groups and a lot of people who did a lot of dedication, who put their minds, hearts, souls, energy out into the streets and did one thing or another to try to end institutionalized racism in America and to try to end the war in Vietnam, etc. And when young folks especially look back upon that period, I'm here to try to talk to you to grab some of the positive, progressive things and creative things we did and get newly creative with new ideas. You know, we didn't have computer technology back then. You know, we had tape recorders. We didn't have no personal camcorders that we could pick up and go out and just video the police and stuff like this and put it on television or put it on the internet or something like this here. Or just make video leaflets. Nowadays you can make video leaflets, you know what I mean? Pass them out free to the people in the community to unite them in some political move, etc. But this can be done nowadays. So I'm just saying it is about the future. In other words, all civil human rights issues that we talked about in the 60s, really today in a broader sense and a much more profound sense of where we're at, is also interconnected and interrelated with all the environmental problems and all the ecological and environmental problems, etc. I mean, when we see the corporate money rich around the world with NAFTA and GATT helping them to concentrate more economic concentration of money, owning and controlling 90% of all the goods and services in the world, concentrating more political power through getting NAFTA and GATT, etc., hey, we're losing power. We're getting crumbs. We got to get more legislation and policy that makes us the people, with the goal objective of future world of cooperation and humanism, where that empowerment makes human sense to us for the whole earth. Power to the people. Thank you very much.
That was Bobby Seale, co-founder of the Black Panther Party, speaking at a community event June the 20th, sponsored by New Haven, Connecticut's International Festival of Arts and Ideas. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203 331 9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikitar. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Zelfia Hunter, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Prue Cullen.